Hi, it's Dave. Welcome. Today, I'm joined by Oliver Cameron. He is the VP of Product at Cruise. They are a driverless autonomous driving company. They have just rolled out autonomous driving taxis or driverless taxis in San Francisco. I thought it's just a fascinating milestone. I think it's a fascinating company. So I've invited Oliver on to just kind of detail and give us a glimpse into Cruise, what they're doing, the future of autonomous driving and transport. So welcome, Oliver. How are you doing?
Thank you for having me. It's a really exciting time, so I'm doing awesome. Thank you for asking.
Awesome, yeah. I noticed your Q&A on Twitter about the driverless taxis on SF, and I was just fascinated by what you guys are doing. Before we go into the actual, you know, taxis in SF, can you give us just a breakdown of what Cruise is as a company? You know, when did it start? How large is it?
For sure. So Cruise is about 7 years old, and we are 2,300 people. Primarily focused in the Bay Area, and we build self-driving cars, and these self-driving cars have been stress tested in the most complex environments in the world, and we put them to work in both ride hail and delivery applications.
Okay. I'm curious. So actually more on Cruise itself. I was noticing that I think it's Kyle Vogt. He started it in 2013, and you guys have a lot of ties back to Silicon Valley with, it seems like, Y Combinator, that the early founders went through, which is, you know, kind of the preeminent startup incubator in Silicon Valley. And then it seems like in 2016, Cruise was acquired by GM. Was it later spun out as an independent company?
Correct. So GM acquired Cruise. And then a few years post that, Cruise re-spun out and received investment from folks like SoftBank and Honda.
Okay. Fantastic. And then according to my notes, I guess last year you guys were valued over $30 billion. And I think what some people who might not, who aren't familiar with Cruise don't understand, you guys have been at this for a while and your technologies are actually in cars. For example, with GM Super Cruise, highway kind of autopilot, that's developed by Cruise. So you guys have been at this for quite a while. That's correct, right?
So Cruise, the company, is focused on fully autonomous driving. Okay. We do collaborate with GM on areas like Super Cruise, but what we're focused on as a company is fully autonomous, no human in the front seat driving.
Okay, got it. So you guys are all in on this driverless service. Is the focus on driverless taxis, like, you know, in these cities or areas, or is more of the priority and focus eventually long-term to have driverless consumer cars where people purchase them and use them themselves?
That's definitely part of the evolution, right? So the way we think of this is we're going to start by offering driverless taxis on the streets of the most complex cities in the country. And from that point, we'll be able to really begin to nail down the unit economics. We'll have hundreds of thousands, millions of people moving in these things every day. And then from that point, we can continue to refine it, continue to expand the areas in which it can serve until a point not too far from now where it makes total sense to put this into personal autonomous vehicles. And we recently announced that we'd be collaborating with GM on a personal autonomous vehicle.
Okay, got it. So it's an interesting and a fascinating choice of strategy where instead of choosing kind of the easier, let's say, geographic locations, you guys have started to double down on some of the most complex, challenging urban environments, for example, in San Francisco. Can you kind of maybe unpack some of that reasoning on why you guys are choosing kind of some of the most complicated areas first?
Absolutely. So I can actually come at this from a rather interesting perspective because I started a company that was acquired by Cruise about a year ago called Voyage. And Voyage was all about starting in the simplest possible place which has real consumer demand. And for us, that was moving senior citizens in retirement communities with fully driverless cars. Retirement communities, slow, very predictable. And for 5 years, I was obsessed that this was the best way to bring this technology to market, right? So then the question is, well, why join forces with Cruise, which has a almost polar opposite approach to this problem, which is start in the most complex places. And my thinking has totally evolved on this over the years. I think what's absolutely critical for this business is scale. It's important, yes, to bring it to market, but it's even more critical to bring this to market at large scale. And finding the path to do that the quickest is what's most important here. And again, my initial interpretation was bringing it to market fast in simpler places could enable you to expand, you know, over time. But I don't believe in that anymore. I think it's important to start in the most complex place because that's the most efficient enabler of scale.
Okay. So what about, I guess, these complex environments allows you to scale, you think, better? Is it just the sheer amount of population and usage that it gets, the data that is kind of put into flywheel to improve the system, or are there some other factors, you think?
It's really two things. Firstly, it is that on a per mile basis, you just experience more chaos, right? You just experience more things happening, and not just the same things more frequently, but more bizarre, diverse things happening. Mm-hmm. And you're exposed to that all the time in San Francisco and, yeah, and the other cities sure. you work in. And then the second thing that I do believe is also important is to think about the demand for this product, right? So self-driving cars will only go as far as the amount that people actually want them in their lives. And one of the things that I've heard time and time again is that driving in San Francisco is a genuine nightmare for people. And because it's so complex. So the technology can improve by being in these areas, but people also want them in these areas because they just don't want to drive in these areas. And those two things really for me are the most critical ingredients to a viable self-driving car company.
Interesting. So is the kind of the business approach or strategy is you take on, let's say, San Francisco, super hard place, but there is a lot of population, there's scale, there's, you know, edge cases that all feed into improving the system. And if you're able to crack one super hard city, then you can go to the next super hard city and scale very fast that way. Versus compared to, let's say, you're in a senior citizen community with, you know, and you're doing it slowly, maybe it would take forever to get the improvements, right, and the scale that you need. Is that kind of the thinking behind, this approach?
That's exactly right. I mean, Another way to think of it is by solving the hardest place first, you have a technology which can be generalizable to other similarly complex environments. If you start in simple places, you have to rethink your technology every time you go to somewhere more difficult. And it's tempting because getting to market fast, of course, who doesn't want that, right? Like everyone wants that. But it can lead to a lot of rewrites. It can lead to a lot of being effectively slowing down your time to scale. So yeah, it takes more effort, more money, more people to solve a place like San Francisco. But I'm incredibly confident that once you've solved San Francisco, that it can scale in a very generalizable fashion to many other complex places.
Sure. Would you say that by focusing on a difficult area first, that perhaps one of the biggest challenges, or perhaps even the biggest challenge, is the safety element, meaning you have so many crazy things happening left and right, people popping up in San Francisco, you know, dogs running across the street, pedestrians, you know, opening doors, all sorts of crazy scenarios that, you're kind of putting yourself in this place. So how do you mitigate kind of that higher exposure to risk in kind of these urban environments like San Francisco?
So one way to think of this is I would consider the V1 of any self-driving car that it responds reactively to its environment, right? So it responds to a pedestrian walking out into the street, responds to or interacts with a car at an intersection, stuff like that, the basics, right? And you put that car in San Francisco and really most other places, it's going to be very jerky. It's going to be hitting the brakes quite frequently. It's going to not be at all a great customer experience. Mm-hmm. A self-driving car, let's call it a V2 for a second, that I'm really impressed with at Cruise, is the car itself knowing the impact of its interactions with others around it and weighing up those judgment calls. So by the car knowing if I do this, that's going to result in this other car or this other pedestrian doing this, weighing up all of those different potentials, it leads to a dramatically smoother, more comfortable, and more natural sort of driving experience. So for example, an example here would be that at a double parked vehicle, the self-driving car comes to a stop behind it. And we see that the coast is clear behind us. Now we start to navigate around that double parked vehicle, and we suddenly see a car that's oncoming. We're in the opposing lane of traffic, we're navigating around, and a V1 self-driving car would just hit the brakes hard, right? It's in the oncoming lane of traffic, there's something driving towards us, it's really quite rudimentary. But a self-driving car's V2 it would say, I'm gonna complete this maneuver because by me driving forward, it's likely to stop that guy that's oncoming from trying to drive through me, right? That would be a silly decision. And as a customer in that AV, that's exactly what a human would do. They'd want the car to continue navigating around, complete its maneuver, not hit the brakes, not be super reflective of what's going on around it. Now, there's cases where we, of course, need to react at the last second to things that occur that we didn't foresee. But in those cases, again, the car is utterly safe, and that it's honestly the fully driverless experience is an incredible one to be in an AV with no human in the front seat and see the car make all of these decisions in real time. It's just so impressive.
Yeah, definitely. Going off of your version one and version two, so would you say like version one, the reactive one is, let's say, you know, is more of this car that just is maybe hyper cautious, you know, anything they just stop and just kind of is trying to avoid, you know, hitting objects and people, et cetera. Version two, it seems like is adding a lot of predictive elements, factoring in a lot of future possibilities and choosing routes and plans that aren't just reacting to avoid, but actually choosing, you know, maybe the optimal situation. And if that's the case, like what is enabling? And you're saying that this is kind of where you're basing your confidence, right, as a company in terms of being able to roll out in urban environments, is you're saying we are in version two, right? But I mean, it seems like what's enabling that transition from version one to version two? Is it how machine learning neural nets are progressing? Is it just more data? Is it just, are you guys doing more like 3D vector space and applying different reinforcement learning algorithms, like different things to like, you know, as a CEO of a previous, you know, AI driving company, like I'm curious to hear your kind of technical angle on what's the key enabling factor you think
absolutely
behind this.
Probably the best summary of V2 is the AV is aware of its impact on the surroundings, right? It's aware of its negotiations and what impact that has on others, and then weighs those just the same as the impact that others have on us. So definitely there's a lot of machine learning that goes into this. And we revealed tons of this stuff at an event we hosted called Under the Hood. It's all on YouTube. Anyone can watch it and see.
Yeah, I saw that. That was a great, awesome. Actually, I'll link that whole presentation in the video description. I thought you guys did a great job there. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, we wanted to be utterly open about the capabilities of our vehicle and what's driving these sorts of technical improvements. So you'll see in that presentation a whole number of different advancements we've made in the field of machine learning to again, and weigh our impact on these other objects, because it is, again, a machine learning problem. It's looking at a slew of scenarios that happen in the most complex places, and then using that data, continuously improving it over time to say, we're going to get better at the handling of these situations. So, I could go on about the particulars, the minutiae of it, but I'd really recommend watching Under the Hood. There's some experts there that do a much better job than I could.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was a great presentation. Is there a version three, you think, after kind of version two?
I'm sure there is, right? I'm sure there's a version 10 somewhere, a version 20 at some point.
Sure.
I will say, I think there is, at this point in self-driving cars, the most important thing that's been solved by a company like Cruise is that confidence in removing the safety driver, right? What once you hit that point, I'd hate to say it gets iterative because that's really not the case, but it's less about inventing something new and more about refining what you have and scaling what you have. Mm-hmm. And reaching that point where we feel we have the confidence to remove the safety driver, that's a big version. And then there isn't necessarily a need to reinvent a whole bunch of what we have. I'm sure we will, again, in the scheme of ensuring this can scale faster, ensuring the experience gets better. But reaching that point of removing the safety driver, just the most important point of AV technology development to date.
Yeah, yeah. Now, I definitely agree. When you remove this driver and you're in a driverless taxi, like I've seen some of your guys' footage, it's just a game changer for sure. Let's dive into some of the specifics and details of your San Francisco rollout. So is it my understanding, so are the cars electric Chevy Bolts, and then you've added on equipment. So can you maybe describe, like, is it, are you adding LiDAR and other sensors, and kind of what is the actual hardware that you guys are using?
Absolutely. So yes, we have a close partnership with GM. These are Chevy Bolts, and we do add a myriad of different sensors and compute to these vehicles. We add LiDARs, cameras, radars. The radars are custom built, and we have that capability in-house. And this whole package is integrated and validated by GM.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then what is the, what does the driverless rideshare program look like right now? For example, when, where is it available? Like, what times is it available, et cetera?
For sure. So it's currently available between 10 p.m. and 6 a.m. In a very broad swath of San Francisco. And we're very focused today on serving nighttime applications. So, you know, one of the things we learned about a year ago at Cruise is just how dangerous nighttime driving is. It's surprising and still surprises me. So for example, 25% of the overall miles are driven during nighttime, but 50% of the fatalities occur during nighttime. And you might ask, why is this the case? Well, firstly, there's a hell of a lot, unfortunately, of drink driving that occurs. There's also distracted driving. There's also people that are incredibly tired. There's also people that have vision issues and driving in the dark, things like that. So overall, we thought, okay, nighttime, it's got a pain point, and we also want to roll this out patiently and make sure that we're doing so safely. So pairing those two things together, enabling us to get to market while solving an actual customer pain point, that felt like the right thing to do in the scheme of rolling this technology out.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. I mean, so 10 p.m. to 6 a.m. Is that Monday to, or Sunday to Saturday all week?
All week, yeah.
Okay. And so, and what percent of like the city is it kind of covering right now, you think?
We have a map that we've published. It's, I don't want to guess a percentage.
Okay.
It's a rather significant chunk of land, though. You know, there's use cases in there. It serves a large population of San Francisco.
Okay. And then the max miles per hour?
That's 25 miles 25. An hour.
Okay. And then it's also in terms of, at least the last time I heard, you guys weren't charging. It was a free service, right, up until this point?
Correct. So today we have applied for our sixth and final permit in order to charge customers and launch commercial services. That was filed, I believe, 2 months ago, something like that. And we're on the cusp of receiving that permit, which will then unlock our ability to charge for this driverless service. We did just unlock our service to public customers. So we have public riders today moving at those time periods in fully driverless cars. They aren't yet paying for those rides, but like I said, they soon will.
And then in terms of regulation, so is this California that's regulating kind of the how this is rolled out in a sense?
Correct. There's two bodies that we work with primarily on this. It's the DMV and the CPUC, and it's been an awesome collaboration.
Okay. And then how many passengers are you serving per day? Do you guys have a rough kind of, you know, estimate there?
We haven't shared that just yet. Okay. But I will say it's been incredible to see the demand on the wait list. Yeah. And just to see how fast that's grown. It's clear a lot of people in San Francisco want fully driverless cars.
Yeah. So before this, you guys were doing like employee only, right? Driverless. And then how many years were you doing that for before you guys opened it to public?
We were moving employees for about 6 months, something like that. We've been doing driverless testing, though, for far longer than that time period.
Yeah.
We opened that internal service about 6 months ago.
Okay. So what does the whole experience look like? Can you kind of walk us through, like, is there an app? Do you just, is it just like Uber? You just kind of say, pick me up, and then the car comes and you just walk in, jump in, and then takes you to your place?
Pretty much. It's so today the user downloads an app and they request a car and they unlock the car from the app. They jump in. There's a big tablet. They go through the experience. That said, so the high level steps look very familiar, right, to someone that's used Uber. What's very different, though, is that when you don't have a human incentive behind the wheel, right? A human driver has incentives. They might get paid more for being in this area of the city. They might be tired. They might be hungry, like all of these different things. Once you remove those incentives, the product really starts to look very different. So what I mean by this is that, as an example, the AV will pull over exactly where you want it to be. So if you're on the streets of San Francisco, I don't know, 10 p.m., 11 p.m. at night, and you want to be picked up precisely in this location where this streetlight is, right outside this bar that has a whole bunch of people outside, the AV will do that. It's not incentivized to go 200 meters back or 200 meters forward. It's not going to miss the instruction. It's always going to stop in that precise location. And one of the things we're hearing loud and clear from our customers is that control, that feeling that you have full control over this experience and there isn't a third party, is really, really powerful. And it unlocks a whole bunch of new applications that frankly get me quite excited.
Yeah, I mean that's a fascinating kind of angle to look at it, kind of the incentives, right? Because the current ride-hail system, you're dealing with, you know, the rider and also the driver, also the network itself. But it's like if you take away kind of the driver and you just kind of align things with the rider, then like you're saying, they can be picked up anywhere. But then also, like, time-wise, like, you know, sometimes drivers like cancel last minute on Uber or Lyft and it's like they don't want to pick you up, or you're driving in the car and then they're playing this music you don't want them to play, or etc. It seems like you could radically transform the ride-hailing experience if you kind of focused on the rider, you know, time, location, style, everything. How are you guys looking at this? Like, can you think you guys can provide like a radically, you know, better experience with ride-hail?
Absolutely. I mean, you listed off a number of different examples there as well that give our customers control over the experience. One of my favorite other examples is that, let's say, again, you're getting dropped off late at night and the AV firstly, again, pays attention to the exact point in which you want to be dropped off. But then the moment that you're dropped off, the AV or a human-driven vehicle might just drive away, right? You haven't gotten your doorstep yet, and the human-driven vehicle is incentivized to go to its next trip. Now, an AV is not necessarily incentivized by those things, right? It's incentivized to make sure that that rider enjoyed that experience and wants to ride again. So that AV will wait outside that building with big lights on, right? And, you know, there's been, you know, issues with, of course, crime in cities that we know can be helped by just having a vehicle parked stationary with lights on right outside your doorstep until you get in that doorstep. And when you control that experience and you say when the AV can go to its next trip, again, you just feel like you're in control of this. So yeah. This is why, not to keep hammering on this, but this is why nighttime to us is so important. It strikes me as one of the areas that the human-driven equivalents might struggle the most to improve on, because again, human incentives. But if we can make a dent in that and we can make that experience dramatically better for people moving at night, dramatically safer, just more preferential, that's going to be one of the first times that I believe we'll see self-driving cars become the preferred mode of transportation, right? And it may happen in just that time period first before it happens, you know, in 24/7. But if that happens first, that's a really big moment. And again, one we're very focused on.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I mean, it's just to think about, like, fundamentally, you know, a driverless taxi service can be so much better than, you know, human driven service. I was even thinking as you're talking, like you could have driverless security patrol cars in different neighborhoods or places, you know, that patrol areas, but it's so cost efficient because you don't have a human in the picture, you know. I'm curious about availability. So like, you know, compared to, let's say, current ride hailing, you know, options out there, Uber, Lyft, et cetera, if you have like the exact same number of car or driverless taxis versus, let's say, human-driven taxis, what does it look like in terms of availability to the rider? Like, can the driverless taxi system be much more available, quicker, can it get to the people quicker, et cetera? And if so, like, how does that work? What are the mechanics behind that that make it, let's say, more advantageous?
For sure. So first and foremost, our entire fleet is uniform, and that is, of course, fully electric. So that provides, you know, benefits for the planet by being fully electric and across the entire fleet. And secondly, by being uniform and all driving the same, because of the fact it's autonomous and electric, you do get additional benefits from that as well. You get predictability about ETAs, you get efficiency predictability. And another thing that's, not to keep hopping on the human incentives, but when we tell a robot, go to this location because at this time every day we see this spike in demand from this location, there is no debate. The robot does it, right? And it gets on its way and it makes it to that location and it picks up whatever passengers are in that region. So I think it's a mix of the fact these vehicles are uniform, and that is going to be incredibly advantageous. And then the fact there isn't that human behind the wheel. The last thing I'll mention is that we do think about, so obviously in the human equivalence, it's distributed ownership. Right, everyone owns their vehicles, and in fact that can be quite powerful for these companies as well. But by also owning and operating the fleet, we feel we can deliver a set of a product that is far more predictable. So think about the vehicles continuously being cleaned. Think about when you get in that vehicle the first time, and then you get in the 10th time, it being the same experience every time. And that's something that the ride hail companies currently struggle with today, that, you know, from one ride to another, the experience can be amazing to terrible. And we think that's because of that distributed sort of ownership that occurs. So I'm excited to see what the potential is, and I'm excited to see what happens when you remove some of these human incentives just to enable these AVs to better serve the communities in which they operate.
Yeah. I think it was in one of your videos, I'm not sure which one, but it was, I think it was a person was trying to, it was like a more of a promo video of a person trying to hail a driverless taxi every day after work or something, or maybe some situation. But then because it's like autonomous, like it seems like there would be an amazing advantage where you can actually guarantee pickup. You know, let's say every day at 6 p.m., right when I get off work, I want my driverless taxi there to take me home. In the current human ride-hailing system, if you add that driver kind of ability to cancel, right, and to say, I'm out of here, right, I don't want this ride, it seems like it just messes up the entire reliability, right, of appointments. But if you take that out and, you know, the system doesn't cancel, can't cancel, it guarantees your 6 p.m. Ride to home every day. That seems like a huge game changer, like complete, like different service. It's almost like a different service to me, you know? I don't know how you can, I mean, what are your thoughts kind of with that application?
I honestly couldn't agree more. I think it's that when products appear that bring a 10x improvement in reliability to something, it really changes our minds about using those products more frequently, right? So rideshare today or ride-hail today, I don't know about you, but non-AVs, I use those quite infrequently at this point. But I still use them from time to time. And there's been this discussion around, well, you know, if you rewind five, 7 years ago, Uber's promise was, we're going to effectively one day replace personal ownership, right? And the promise hasn't really worked out, right? It hasn't hit the reliability that people wanted. It hasn't met the experience that people wanted. So people have stayed with their own personal vehicles. And I'm not advocating that AVs are going to replace personal vehicles, but that reliability improvement that you're talking about, I feel will convince a hell of a lot more people that this could become their predominant mode of transportation. Because if you can start to depend on it just as much as you can depend on your car being in your garage, you know, suddenly your options or suddenly your mind changes about how you might use this technology. So yeah, I think it's a meaningful differentiation. It might seem on the surface almost not super exciting compared to a car that can drive itself, but those reliability improvements, that it gets there at 6 p.m. every time you want it, that's going to be huge.
Yeah, it just seems like fundamentally, like it could increase usage, you know, 10 times, 100 times, who knows what the order of magnitude is, just because it seems like fundamentally it's a different service if you can rely on it, you know, 100%. Also, you know, same car, you know, no smells, no, you know, discomfort at all. It's just like, yeah, it's definitely an amazing thing.
It's consistency, right? It's that every time you use the product, you'll expect the same things. And if it happens frequently enough, you'll come to depend on it. Yeah. And this happens in every product, right? If the product experience lives up to its expectations, one out of five times, you're not going to use it. If it does it every five times, then you're going to use it all the time.
Yeah. Yeah. Exciting stuff. I mean, when you kind of combine like some of the stuff you're saying with this autonomous vehicle technology can transform safety with driving, you know, accidents, injuries, death. It transforms transportation. And like, how are you kind of looking at this 10 years from now? Like, what is the world in transport? Are you confident that driverless taxis will be rolled out in, you know, most metro areas? Do you think that will be, you know, one of the predominant, you know, forms of transportation? How will that change, you know, lives as we know it?
Absolutely. In 10 years, we'll have robo-taxis, let's call it, operating in all major cities in the US, I believe. And we'll also have personal AVs in certain areas as well. It's important to think of these geofences as continuously expanding over time, right? So I know a lot of folks think a lot about geofences and how tight they might feel today and how limiting in some cases they might feel, although our geofence is not limiting. But when the geofence gets so big that you don't even have to think about it because you leave that geofence one every 6 months or something, then, you know, all of a sudden, again, we'll be able, you'll look out your window and you'll see a cruise fully autonomous taxi, you'll see someone owning a car that's moving from point A to point B while not paying attention because it is fully driverless. I'm very confident in 10 years we'll see those things.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. All right, so going back to, let's say, San Francisco, what's the plan to expand, let's say, you know, to grow that geofence, expand locally, but also, you know, possibly to other cities? What's the strategy, and do you have any general kind of rough timeline sense as well?
For sure. So first and foremost, we are focused on San Francisco, huge rideshare market and the place that Cruise began. So we're going to nail that first and foremost. And we've launched fully driverless vehicles, 10 p.m. to 6 a.m. Customers today are using those in the real world. We'll soon welcome paid users in a short while. And then from that point, it's going to be firstly about ensuring that nighttime application is as awesome as we want it to be. We're going to make it a leap above the ride-hail offerings of today. And then gradually and patiently, we will roll that out to other more expansive times, eventually until 24/7. We're not sharing timing just yet, but seeing what I see of the AV every day, it's not very far away at all. And then from that point, we will introduce other vehicles. So you can see it on my shirt, the Origin. We just filed for a NHTSA exemption today to deploy these vehicles on the roads of San Francisco and others across the US. and we'll introduce this vehicle to San Francisco, and again, a time not too far from now. And then expansion from there, we're going to prioritize the most populous ride-hail markets and really invest significantly in bringing those online. And then eventually we'll introduce personal autonomous vehicles, and those will, of course, be owned by users, and those will be used in similar markets, albeit, again, the geofences at that point will likely not matter to people.
Mm-hmm. Got it. What's the advantage? I noticed, let's say, with your shirt with the Origin vehicle, I've seen some videos on, you know, the construction has made. It seems like it could fit a lot of people, very comfortable, opens in the middle, front, back, all that. What's kind of the fundamental advantage of, or what's the motivation and need to create a separate vehicle like that versus just retrofitting, you know, existing vehicles out there?
It's a great question. So first and foremost, the Origin is purpose built to be fully autonomous. And that means that its sensor positioning, its architecture, it's perfectly optimized for fully autonomous driving. So that's really important. The second thing is the customer experience. This is a very different experience than getting into a car. You get in, you see expansive amounts of room, you sit down, it's super comfy, it's designed to be shared across hundreds and thousands of riders per day, and it just feels like this this step change in rider comfort. And then you have the architecture of the vehicle itself. It's designed to be run all day, right? That this isn't a vehicle that has a cap of 100,000, 150,000 miles. This is designed to be run every day for a very long period of time in shared applications. And we think that the combination of those three things is a really compelling option for customers. They'll get, again, a consistent and awesome user experience every time they get into an Origin.
Moving back to kind of this rollout, so San Francisco, expanding within San Francisco, then to, you know, other metro areas, what would you say would be the constraining factor? Like the thing that limits or determines how fast you're able to expand service versus not? Meaning, and let's, for example, for the sake of this discussion, maybe shelve the regulatory kind of constraints for now and just focus on technical for a second. Like, you know, as a technical co-founder yourself, like, what is it you think technically that your team is focused on that will determine the pace of, you know, expansion and improvement of the service?
Sure. So firstly, I'll tell you what isn't holding us back. Then I'll talk about what I think does. So firstly, LiDAR doesn't hold us back. Mapping doesn't hold us back. And those two things I know get talked about a lot as scale limitations, but we feel very confident that those two things can scale. And I am happy to expand on why. But the area I see as our biggest limitation to scale today is simply AV capabilities. So what I mean by that is the ability for the AV to handle a new section of road or a new road feature that we haven't stress tested and validated just yet. San Francisco really shows, you know, a wide variety of the US roadway, but it doesn't show us everything, right? It doesn't show us highway speeds, for example. It doesn't show us even 45 mile an hour driving in most cases. So what we've done is build an AV that's really, really adept at handling the most complex possible driving at and around that 25 to 30 mile an hour number. And then as we expand to new cities, that's when we bring online these new capabilities. And this is exactly what we started doing. So we started doing this last year in Phoenix and brought online a huge amount of driving in Phoenix in partnership with Walmart. We've actually been testing in Phoenix for quite some time more, but a partnership with Walmart. And this has already started to bear fruit. We now drive regularly at 45 miles an hour in Phoenix with our Cruise AVs. And what's going to happen is eventually, as we get into our first handful of other cities, we'll be exposed to almost all of the features that are common in all cities. And that will be a big point for us to say, okay, now there isn't really any other AV maneuvers or AV capabilities left to build. It's simply a matter of getting the fleet and getting the operations folks on the ground in those locations. What's also important to note is that we do have a operational element to our vehicles. So I mentioned mapping, that has some operational element. We also have remote assistance. So our AVs drive entirely by themselves, and then from time to time, they may see something that it feels unable to handle. And in that moment, it can request a human who can help the AV with some hints through that situation. And this is also going to be important for expansion purposes, right? If that AV encounters something in a new city that it hadn't seen in another city, then the ability for the AV to understand, I don't know how to handle this exactly, I'm going to have a human who's going to be able to give me some hints about how to handle it, that's going to be a really important accelerant to scale.
Mm-hmm. With this kind of remote help feature, how does it work? I mean, let's say that EV gets stuck in a situation, you know, they're not sure what to do. Is a human monitoring the ride all the time, or is it only when the EV or the AV calls for help that the human jumps in, evaluates the system? Does human actually take over and drive through, or does the human just give, you know, a hint like that direction? Like how do the mechanics of this work?
For sure. So first and foremost, there is no continuous human monitoring. Our AVs, fully driverless, they're on their own, they're driving and making their own decisions. However, when they come to certain situations which the AV detects, I need some help, then it can request for a human to give input. And what's important there is that the remote assistant, imagine this kind of like Minority Report style UI in front of them, all these sensor feeds, they don't drive the car. They simply plot dots on the road for the AV to follow. The AV is using its own technology to navigate that situation. And what's even more cool is that exact scenario, what the human fed into that scenario, is then fed back into our other machine learning models to say, hey, this is what the human said we should do. Learn that behavior so that the next time you see similar circumstances, you can handle it yourself. What's also cool is when the AV understands when it is stuck. So this is, it's a surprisingly difficult challenge to know when the AV should request for help or when it should try and attempt it by itself. And this is another reason cities matter. So here's an example. You're in a long line of cars at a traffic light. Well, the AV's behind one car and the traffic light is red, so everyone's waiting. Now, maybe our AV doesn't have perception of the traffic light yet. It's too far back. How does the AV know I'm simply stuck in traffic, or these are all double parked vehicles and I should navigate around them? That's a really tough problem, right? Well, it turns out you can, like humans do, learn when to know that that is the situation you should call for help, or a situation the AV should just be patient and to wait. Because if you're just using silly, dumb things like timers and other things like that, it's not very efficient. So what we built are machine learning models that understand the circumstances of the traffic around us to know, okay, yeah, the AV actually does really need some help in this situation, or frankly, just wait there, AV, like you've got this, just give it a moment.
Got it. For this remote helps feature here, how do you guys deal with like the time issue where, you know, the AV calls for help, the human has to kind of look at, analyze situation, there's a gap. Are you finding that this to be a difficult thing where the AV has to wait a bit, or are you guys finding where it's not a big deal that, you know, the time is minimal and it's a minimal disruption?
You don't really notice it as a customer, honestly. And the reason being is that the way we've built our AVs is with multiple connection redundancies in mind. So the moment the AV detects it's not able to handle something, within a split second, someone somewhere, one of our remote assistance advisors is taking a look at the situation, plotting that path, and in milliseconds, that path is back to the AV. The AV is then navigating that situation, and the customer never really notices, honestly.
Got it. Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, obviously that data also goes back into your machine learning algorithms, neural nets to prevent that or to make your system smarter, you know, so you're actually, it's an investment, it seems like, you know, to improve the system for sure. Back on your LiDAR maps approach. So can you explain what your take on the necessity of LiDAR and maps or high definition maps? What does it bring, you know, to your guys' AV capabilities?
So the way to think about maps to me is that you have this database of road features that the AV knows ahead of time it's going to handle, right? So you have this database that, by the way, we assume is imperfect because the world is always changing, right? But you have this database that says, we think there should be a stop sign here. We think there's a traffic light here. We think this lane merges like this. And you give these hints to the AV. And first and foremost, this just delivers a more predictable customer experience, right? The AV is not having to figure out in real time what's what and where things are. It simply has that input as a prior. And that, again, we believe enables a more consistent user experience. And then on the LiDAR front, we don't really think of it as LiDAR or cameras, right? We think of it LiDAR and radar and cameras. And the reason being is that the combination of those three things, we just believe yields the most safety, right? We think the combination of those three sensors yields the most accurate view of the world. And that view of the world then enables our car to drive the most consistently, the most smoothly, and just the most safely. And at some point in time, I am sure that there will be less of a need for one of those three sensors. And I happen to believe cameras will be around for the longest of those three modalities. But at this particular point in time, it feels like if you want to deploy fully driverless cars, no human in the front seat, that all three of those sensor modalities are necessary to do so.
Mm-hmm. Got it. So you guys are optimizing basically for what you guys think is the safest, most capable approach right now. You guys think all the LiDAR, radar, camera sensors combined together will give you the most, the best data, the best capabilities, right?
It is the safest, but I do also strongly believe it's the best experience for the customer, right? So the reason being is that when it comes to the ride quality, your ability to detect all these objects and do so smoothly really has an impact on your ability to drive smoothly. If your detections are flickering, your detections don't have correct metadata assigned to them, the speed is off, if you're detecting things late because of occlusion, whatever it might be, then the customer is going to feel that in the car, right? They're going to feel it because they have a hard brake, they have a swerve, whatever it might be. And by having all three modalities, we basically feel that those three cover for each's weakness, right? And provide then a single set of sensors that brings out what is necessary to deliver a safe and very comfortable ride. Mm-hmm.
Got it. It's interesting. I want to go into some Twitter follower questions. So I posted kind of our interview or letting people know, and we got a bunch of questions from followers. Krishna Mohammed says, what are your thoughts on the ability to scale Cruise's service worldwide? I'm guessing the question is like, we talked about local expansion, but how are you guys thinking about a foreign geographic expansion? Is that something you guys are pushing off because different language signs, different, you know, culture or driving environments, or is that something you guys are actively thinking about and pursuing in the near future?
We're definitely actively thinking about this. We've signed agreements with Dubai to deploy a large amount of Origin vehicles in Dubai. And this is something that's not too far from now. The truth is, this idea of expansion really is informed by the technical capabilities that we have, right? And one of the key things I'd love to hammer home is that a Cruise AV, the technology beneath it, is really generalizable. It's not been built to handle just a single set of circumstances in a single city in a single country. It's really been built to generalize to everywhere, like different driving behaviors, different driving patterns, different sides of the road, whatever it might be. And that we feel will hold us in good stead for expansion to other countries.
Mm, yeah, it's interesting. Dubai, yeah. It seems like there'd be a lot of countries fascinated by driverless taxis for sure. Adam says, pickup locations. Why does the user have to walk to a bus stop instead of the car picking you up where you are? Is he mistaken? Can the driverless taxi right now just go wherever the rider is?
He is mistaken, yes. So the autonomous vehicle can pick you up at any point, any address in our operational domain in San Francisco. There's no sort of fixed routes or anything like that.
Got it. Beast Driven says, does the driverless taxi work when it's raining, snowing, or foggy? So if it suddenly starts pouring mid-ride, what happens?
So our AVs can handle a certain amount of rain, and they handle when it rains really hard safely. But in the extremes of rain, the AV does pull over. And okay. Same with fog and same with snow as well.
Got it. I'm assuming that likely will change over time as your system increases in capability, right?
Correct. The ambition for sure is anything that a human can safely drive through is exactly what an autonomous vehicle can drive through. But today, again, safe rollout. If it starts to downpour with rain, always better to pull over to the side of the road.
Mm-hmm. Juan Ugarte says, how does Cruise plan to expand the system into a 24-hour service?
So what our customers will see is progressive expansion, right? We'll see that we open up new time zones or time periods. And that said, our initial focus really is on nighttime and just nailing that experience for customers, delivering something better than the traditional ride hail out there today. The technical details of that I can't share, but it's again going to happen as a smooth rollout that we think is the right way to deploy this technology.
Got it. John Luca says, how many vehicles does Cruise operate at once?
So our fleet, fully driverless fleet, is permitted for up to 200 vehicles this year, and we'll be deploying that many vehicles.
Awesome. And then I'm curious, for those who maybe aren't familiar with Cruise or, let's say, Waymo, is there anything like distinctive between, let's say, Cruise's approach versus Waymo's approach? How do you explain that, you know, for the layperson?
So Waymo deployed the world's first fully driverless service in Phoenix, right? And that happened, I believe, in 2017. And that's a huge moment and something that I think they should be absolutely celebrated for. Cruise took an approach that said, we're going to spend a little more time getting this right in more complex areas first and foremost, and thus prioritize San Francisco. And Waymo is now moving from Phoenix to San Francisco and focusing on their driverless efforts in San Francisco. And it's our belief that our approach has yielded, you know, the world's first fully driverless vehicle in San Francisco. And I'd say that articulates the difference in approach, that they started with a simpler place and tried to transition to a harder place. We just stayed firm with the harder place. Mm-hmm. From a product perspective, I couldn't speak to that just yet, but we also believe there'll be, you know, significant differences there too.
Yeah, definitely. I want to just segue into a little bit about your personal journey. So I know you were the CEO and co-founder of Voyage before Cruise, I guess, acquired your company in March of 2021. You're working on self-driving cars for senior citizens. I'm curious, like, and I guess you were at Udacity before that as well. And I noticed, like, I think it was, I forget what video it was, but it was saying kind of like part of your interest or title was like with robotics and AI, or you have background with that. What's your kind of background with your interest in AI and robotics? Like, where does it come from and what makes you excited about those areas?
Absolutely. So growing up, I loved to build products, right? So software was my first thing, being able to take something in my bedroom from something to nothing and release it to the world and see, you know, well, hundreds is a stretch, but tens of people use it and enjoy it. That was a blast. And at a point in time, the skills I'd learned building, you know, rando software seemed to land with a commercial opportunity with the iPhone. The iPhone came to be, and all of a sudden I could go from tens of users of my software to thousands of users of my software because of just how, you know, the distribution of the iPhone took off. And I started building software for the iPhone and loved every minute of that. And that led me to start a company which really endeavored to make the address book more intelligent. This core thing on our phones, this dumb list of people that we have on our phones, seemed like it could be far more intelligent, right? Like you've got all this extra information, all these data sources where you're speaking with these people, but it still is this kind of static, dumb list. So at that particular point in time, I decided to, what technology could solve this, right? And began to dabble in machine learning. And this was just an exposure to something. I instantaneously thought, wow, this has so many ramifications for so many things. This was maybe 2012, something around that. And around that same time period, we started to see machine learning applied in ways that really improved computer vision. Right, look at ImageNet and the DARPA challenges and many other things. And just from that point on, I tried to get my hands on as many materials as I could to learn about it. And through that process, I actually discovered Udacity. And Udacity to me was really my preferred way to learn, you know, at my own speed on my laptop and building as you went. And through learning artificial intelligence through Udacity and through other resources, I decided to get a job there. And that led to me being a part of the teaching of these classes. That led to just so many other cool opportunities. And honestly, just since that point, I've been obsessed with this as a technology. Mm-hmm. So far reaching are its implications. I just don't feel we truly understand what it will enable. And that's mostly why I'm obsessed with it.
Huh, interesting. And where does that kind of your interest with robotics come into this?
So the robotics part came also as a result of Udacity. So we'd built content to teach robotics, machine learning, self-driving cars, flying cars, virtual reality, topics like that. And through that exposure, it seemed like one of the prime ways machine learning would come to life is with robotics, right? This obviously self-driving cars, which I consider a robot, plus lots of other applications. So, you know, through that, honestly, was the main exposure. And the idea as well for me personally that you could build a physical product, that was something I hadn't had too much exposure to. But there's a real magic to it. There's a magic to, again, looking out your window and seeing the thing you built drive by. That's really cool. Mm-hmm. So that's primarily how it happened.
Yeah, because I noticed, like, folks, you know, in machine learning, it's like there's a group of people that kind of look at machine learning as more machine learning, more online, and, you know, but then there's some that, and others that are more fascinated with kind of the merging of, you know, machine learning with, you know, physical products or robots and what that means. Curious, if you could just like take us, help us step back for a minute, and can you help us figure out like where we are in this point of history with AI and robotics? Are self-driving cars kind of the first major consumer AI robot, you know, application rollout in a big way? Are there other types of consumer robot applications that you're excited about in 10, 20 years? Like, where does all this lead? Like, how can you help us understand, you know, our time point in history right now in the bigger picture?
So the best analogy I could probably find today is that the first fully driverless cars feel like the Macintosh. Right? Like you can see something that is dramatically different and dramatically better than what's come before it, but it hasn't really, it's not in every home yet, right? Like Windows as a, you know, the monolith we know today hasn't really taken off in that time period just yet. And it's not everywhere, but you can see the potential. And it was a huge technical feat to bring the Macintosh to life, right? It took decades. Well, as in all the components coming together took decades. And I see very similar things in self-driving cars. It's forced all this investment, all these great minds working on this problem has brought to life this product, which is a big leap of what it came before. but it's not in everyone's hands yet. And there's only a small sample of the population has really got to experience its benefits. So that's the next step. It's scaling this technology. And again, as we know from the kind of PC wars and everything, that can take a while. It can take a long time to get this from thousands of people to tens of thousands to millions, tens of millions. But it will absolutely be worth it. The thing I can say, though, about artificial intelligence is that I do think self-driving cars are a kind of bellwether for other applications. One of the reasons that I did orient towards robotics and machine learning is it does force lots of constraints on the problem, right? You have real-time constraints. Your machine learning models have to respond instantaneously almost to the inputs it's given in order to make safe decisions. And all of those constraints has yielded advancements in the technology. And because of the safety criticality of a self-driving car, it's forced so much innovation that I don't think we've yet seen trickle to other robots or other machine learning applications. And once that does happen, I think we'll see a little bit of a, not a renaissance, that's maybe overblowing it, compared to where we are today, but something that's going to spark a whole bunch of new innovation in robotics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. So with Cruise, where can people find out more about Cruise, and how can they sign up if they're in San Francisco, you know, to be part of the driverless taxi program?
Absolutely. So you can head to getcruise.com, and we have a wait list there that you can sign up for. I'd encourage doing so quick because it's getting quite long.
Awesome. I'll go ahead and link that in the video description. I'll link to also the talk, the tech talk that Cruise did, Under the Hood, a fantastic discussion about their technologies. I'll link to Oliver's Twitter account as well, where he answers questions about their program as well. Oliver, thank you. I want to congratulate you and the team at Cruise for a huge milestone with driverless taxi rollout happening in San Francisco. Wish you guys the best in your pushing of the technology, reducing, accidents, deaths, injuries from human driving, and really, transforming, what the future looks like. So thank you for your time. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. This was fun.
All right. Thanks.